Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG pod overflow, the Cinephobe cold opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
Said the OG pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays. You're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like? Because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora. He's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
Hey, listener, Zach Harper here. Underdog Fantasy, the easiest place to play fantasy sports. Also, fastest growing fantasy app in the industry. Here's how it works. The Pick'em game. Pick whether your favorite players will have a higher or lower stat total in this week's game for a chance to win big. How big, you ask? I'm so glad you asked that question, listener. You can win up to 100 times your money in a single night. Pick between 2 and 5 players, build a pick'em entry. You can also do rivals picks. You can put like Tyrese Haliburton and Jalen Brunson against each other, and whoever has more points, more assists, more rebounds, whatever you want to do, that is your rivals pick. I would maybe go with Jalen Brunson in these playoffs. By the way, in the regular season, Jalen Brunson, scoring tear, going higher on his point totals all the time. Joel Embiid, whenever he did actually play, higher on his scoring totals all the time. Victor Wembanyama, for the next 15, 20 years, here's a pro tip for you, take higher on the blocks. That's right. So you're probably wondering, how do you sign up? Oh my God, listener, you are full of good questions today. Sign up with the promo code DING, that's D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. $250, man, that's a lot. Visit underdogfantasy.com or find them in the App Store. And don't forget to register with our code DING, D-I-N-G, to claim your special pick and first-time deposit offer, up to $250 in bonus cash. Must be 18 or older, 21 or older in Massachusetts, Arizona, 19 or older in Alabama and Nebraska, and present in a state where Underdog Fantasy operates. Terms apply. Concerned with your play, call 1-800-GAMBLER or visit www.ncpgambling.org. Arizona 1-800-NEXT-STEP. That's 1-800-639-8783. Or text NEXT STEP to 53342. New York, call the 24/7 HOPE line at 1-877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369.
You know what we're going to do? We are going to defend ourselves, because Huey P. Newton says that power is the ability to define phenomena and make it act in a desired manner. Power is the ability to define phenomena and make it act in a desired manner. Still, if we have the ability to define it, the only next thing to do is get organized. So when a pig walks up to you, or a pig gets a job with the people, you'll be so organized, you'll be learning some tactics, you'll be learning some revolutionary principles, you'll be having some guns hit out somewhere, you have some proper tactics. That when the pig gets a job with you, the pig is wrong, you whoop your guns out on him, blow him away, and then you have the ability. In fact, you have made that pig act in a desired manner.
Oh, Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the latest edition of the Woke Bros. Of course, I'm your co-host, Big Waz, aka Wozni Lambray, joined as always by my partner on the west side. As always, he could feel the waves from his actual front door.
Yeah. Nando. Surfers are just walking by with their blonde locks.
Exactly.
And, yeah, their chiseled abs.
Nando Vila, what's going on, brother?
How's it going, man? Good to see you.
I'm good. I'm very excited for today's show for several reasons. First of all, we're going to do a review of Judas and the Black Messiah, the latest offering from Warner Brothers. You can catch it on HBO Max. If there are movie theaters that are open in your town, you can catch it at the movies. It's about the life of Fred Hampton and the FBI informant who got him murdered, assassinated, executed. Like, there's no way to say this in a hyperbolic manner. That's what the feds, in assistance with the local police, did to Fred Hampton in Chicago in 1969. We're going to talk about the movie because the movie is fire. And we're going to talk about Fred Hampton's life because it's very relevant to what we do here on Woke Bros every single week. And so we're getting to that. But first, man, we planned on just dorking out on Fred Hampton in this movie. But Rush Limbaugh died this morning. We're recording this on a Wednesday morning. Rush Limbaugh died at the age of 70 years old from lung cancer. He announced his cancer about a year ago to his fans on his radio show and basically explained like the shit was terminal and he wasn't coming back from it. But he continued the show throughout the year. And, you know, it finally came to a head today. First of all, I'm going to say, well, I won't say that I'm happy Rush Limbaugh died because the damage that he's done is already done and will be felt for, I'm talking about decades, decades. We're going to be dealing with the fallout of Rush Limbaugh's contribution to the discourse. But I'm certainly not sad. I'm certainly not going to sit here and pretend that I'm mourning, pretend that this is at all a bad thing, pretend any of those things. This dude did harm to the American society. He did harm to our politics. He did it intentionally to empower himself, to enrich himself. And don't get this twisted. Rush Limbaugh is an arm, was a mouthpiece for the corporate interests, the power elites of America. And he did that. He made sure to, you know, protect their interests by sowing as much hate and vitriol amongst white Americans against these other type of Americans, as much of them as possible.
Yeah.
Best believe Rush Limbaugh never had a bad thing to say about a corporation. He never had a bad thing to say about the power elites outside of the Democratic Party. He never had a bad thing to say about any of the ruling class ever, 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 ever. He always targeted his hate and his vitriol to the most powerless, the most disenfranchised in the country. That's what his job was. His job was to explain to poor white people, if you do have problems, in so much that they are problems, they are the problems manufactured by niggers, spicks, and fags, period. Period. Period, 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 period. That's what his job was. And so, no, we don't mourn Rush Limbaugh today, but we do. And I know Nando is going to be able to basically explain to you what the fairness doctrine was and how important it is to the rise of Limbaugh, because he came to prominence in the 1980s during the Reagan era. And he became extremely popular in talk radio, what we now affectionately call hate radio. And that's how he gained his power. And he weaponized all of this hate, fears, and anxieties to the benefit of the ruling class. And he did so masterfully. And yes, he enriched himself. This dude, I wouldn't be surprised if he's a 100 millionaire by the time he died. This dude got extremely rich off of the work that he did. So he enriched himself. He enriched the ruling class. And we are all worse off for it.
Yeah, I mean, Rush Limbaugh, I forgot that he kind of was still around because he's not as prominent in the culture war as he used to be, like in the 90s when Al Franken wrote a book called Rush Limbaugh is a Big Fat Idiot. The joke's on Al Franken. We're living in Rush Limbaugh's world. We're living in the world that Rush Limbaugh created, essentially. He is one of the original guys in that kind of insane right-wing media ecosystem that we all know and love today. There, you know, Rush Limbaugh walked so that Sean Hannity could run. You know,
Laura
and Fox
Ingraham,
News, yeah,
Hugh Hewitt,
all
you
those
name
guys.
It.
The OG was Rush.
Michelle Malkin. What's the crazy blonde lady's name?
Ann Coulter.
Candace
Owens.
None of these people could exist without the work of Rush Limbaugh.
No, he is the OG in that sense. Like you said, he came to prominence in the 1980s during the Reagan era, which was kind of the birth of the right-wing reaction, which we're still kind of seeing the end of, but has been the dominant stream in American politics since around 1980 when Reagan won. And yeah, like you mentioned briefly, in 1987, the Reagan administration repealed something called the Fairness Doctrine, which was an FCC regulation that sort of regulated the public airwaves, meaning the TV signals and the radio signals. And it was an attempt from the government to do some sort of regulation as to the type of news and information that can be broadcast on its airwaves, right? Because the airwaves are sort of owned by the government and they're licensed to corporations like ABC or CBS or whatever, you know, radio network there could be. And, you know, it was flawed and it, you know, it wasn't perfect or whatever, but it did sort of try to create a certain balance in the type of news that you would get, especially on these airwaves, the Reagan administration basically ignored it and then repealed it in 1987, which was one of the reasons why right-wing talk radio, which is still a very powerful force in American life, was the precursor to Fox News, which is, you know, as everyone knows, an incredibly powerful force in American life. And when we talk about things like fake news on social media and, you know, QAnon and all that stuff, you can't, that doesn't exist without this insane right-wing media ecosystem, of which Rush Limbaugh was probably its biggest ever star. He did it better than most. If you listen to any Rush Limbaugh broadcast, especially back when he was really big in the 90s, I mean, it's impossible to not recognize that the man had a way with talent. Like, he had talent. He was a good broadcaster. Mm-hmm. Like, he knew what he was doing.
Yes, he was.
He was clever.
He was a star.
He was funny. He was, you know, he was a perfect troll. And, you know, so much so that ESPN gave him a job on Monday Night Football and a sort of analyst job because he was so big and powerful that they felt like they could use him to attract, like, a certain type of audience to their network. Obviously, it ended spectacularly bad, as you could have predicted. But, like, that's how big Rush Limbaugh was.
And understand that Limbaugh, and part of his power and his appeal, is he so deeply understood the hypocrisy of the Democratic elite, the Democratic Party elite.
Yeah.
He knew.
Yeah.
He was like, I got them.
Yeah.
I got them.
Yeah.
And I know my people are going to recognize the hypocrisy of these people. And he weaponized it to perfection. Like, these people are not champions of black people.
No.
They're not champions of poor people. They're fucking running a long con on everybody. Yeah. And it's nonsense. And he pinpointed it so perfectly and amazingly. And that's, and quite frankly, that's why, and we try to tell you all the time, the reason why there is so much hate for the Hillarys, for the Clintons, for the Pelosis, and all of these types of people, because Rush Limbaugh could easily weaponize their hypocrisies against them, and his people understood it perfectly. It was like, he is right about that for sure.
Yeah, the libs get owned because the libs deserve to be owned. The problem is when the right wing does it, they're full of shit. But the owning is still kind of valid, if that makes sense. They just, they're coming at it for the wrong reasons and from the wrong direction. But the libs, let's be clear, they get owned because they deserve to be owned. And they open themselves up all the time for that because, yeah, they are kind of full of shit. The sort of stuff that they propagate and they claim to care about, they don't actually care about, which is why it's so easy to point out their hypocrisy on issues like race and poverty, right? Like, they don't actually give a shit about black people or the poor, you know, like, just look at any sort of liberal,
and again,
any liberal school integration initiative in a sort of liberal bastion, like in the Upper West Side of New York, which, you know, votes Democrat all the time.
Never.
They don't like it. They don't like it when there's school integration, when their kids have to go to school with the icky black kids from the outer boroughs. They don't like that, you know?
Yeah, or from uptown. They don't want that. And again, when your message as liberal elites in the Democratic Party is essentially you're appealing to moral, some sort type of moral authority, some type of moral high ground that you stand upon. And, you know, most of it is based on racial harmony and economic equality. And you're fucking rich as hell, and you live in the fanciest parts of America, and there are no black, brown people. There's none of that there. There is no economic equality there. It's so easy for somebody to weaponize that you know, hypocritical stance and just make you look like a fool to an audience who's like, wait a second, these people are lecturing me in my life and my struggles on how to be racially like enlightened and all of this stuff, and these motherfuckers live in the Upper West Side, not a Negro in sight. Nah. I don't want to hear anything else they have to say. And, you know, and again, Rush Limbaugh, can't say it enough. I think we would have been remiss if we didn't talk about Rush and, you know, his role in all of this. And so yeah man, not gonna say rest.
Pour one out for the OG. Yeah.
Pour one out for the OG. Good riddance. You won't be missed on this side, but we have to recognize what the man's contribution is to all of this. And so we move on.
2021. Mental health is finally a thing. So many people are struggling right now and aren't feeling like their normal selves. Therapy helps, and it doesn't have to be sitting around just talking about your feelings. So what is therapy exactly? It's whatever you want it to be. You can talk privately to someone if you feel like you're not dealing well with stress or you're having relationship issues. Whatever you need. It's time to stop being ashamed of normal human struggles and start feeling better, because you deserve to be happy. And now you don't have to worry about finding an in-person therapist near you to help. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist, so you don't have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. It's much more affordable than in-person therapy, and you can start communicating with your therapist in under 48 hours. Join the millions of people who are seeing what therapy is really about. See if it's for you, because you are your greatest asset. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp, and Black Opinions Matter listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/BOM. That's BetterHelp.com/BOM.
What makes them mad about it? What makes them mad about it is that they have black people and white poor people and red poor people and Puerto Rican poor people and Latin American Puerto Rican people of poor people of all descents. They had them caught up in movements based on racism when the Black Panther Party stood up and said that we don't care what anybody says. We don't think you fight fire with fire best. We think you fight fire with water best. We're going to fight racism, not with racism, but we're going to fight with solidarity. We said we're not going to fight capitalism with black capitalism, but we're going to fight it with socialism. We stood up and said we're not going to fight reactionary pigs and reactionary state attorneys like this and reactionary state attorneys like Hanrahan with any other reactions on our part. We're going to fight their reactions with all of us people to get together and have an international proletarian revolution.
Right on.
And that's saying all power to the people.
Right on.
That's saying that no matter what color you are, there's only two classes. And that's saying there's a class over here and there's a class over there. And the reason that this class over here has never did anything to get this class off its back, because this is lower, this is upper. This is the oppressed, this is the oppressor. This is the exploited, this is the exploiter. And these people in this class have divided themselves. They say, I'm black and I hate white people. I'm white and I hate black people. I'm Latin American and I hate hillbillies. I'm hillbilly and I hate Indians. So we're fighting amongst each other. And you heard the testimony of pigs here. You got pigs of all colors, you know that. You got pigs that are white, you got pigs that are black, you even got pigs that are black and white. Propagating the same type of madness that this buffoon Henry had would be propagating if he were here himself. And why? because they want to keep you to believing that I'm your enemy. And that everybody else that's black and that wears a lot of hair on his head and hair on his face, they want to keep you thinking that he's your enemy. Why? Because if ever you would disregard him and overlook him just for a minute and throw away that question of racism and started to deal with a little logic, then there would be no one else you could attack other than Hanrahan, other than Daley, and other than Tricky Dicky Nixon. If you make the right decision, then the press people of the world will get complete satisfaction. I know you return a verdict of not guilty. Thank you.
Judas and the Black Messiah, a film by Shaka King, only his second major motion picture feature ever. He dropped an indie flick called Newlyweeds about a pothead couple going through some stuff, sort of like a dramedy. I did not get to watch this movie, but after watching Jesus and the Black Messiah, which again stars Daniel Kaluuya of Get Out fame, stars Lakeith Stanfield of, you know, Get Out, of Atlanta, of so many things you've seen him be awesome in. And I gotta say, Nando, oh, of course, Jesse Plemons plays Roy Mitchell, the cop, the FBI agent who basically cultivates William O'Neill, Lakeith Stanfield's character, cultivates him as a snitch, as an informant. Dominique Fishback, who you've seen in The Deuce, from HBO, amongst other things. She plays Deborah Johnson, Fred Hampton's baby mom's companion, also a Black Panther member. The cast, they killed this. Just wonderful, wonderful acting performances. But man, first of all, Nando, because before we get into Fred Hampton, I just want to talk about the movie as a work of art, as a film. Shaka King is a great director. Mm-hmm. Like, this dude has visual flair.
Yeah.
He has style. He understands how to shoot action set pieces. He understands how to do sentimentality. He understands how to do morality. His mastery of all these different tones in this film, I was not expecting to see something on the level as far as visual flair as something like a Goodfellas. It's, you can see all of his, you know, his film influences, whether it be Scorsese, whether it be Spike, whether it be Sidney Lumet. Like, this guy has visual style.
Yeah.
And a movie like this that's supposed to be serious biopic of serious Black Panther, Black History Month, blah, blah, blah. I did not expect to see this much flair, man. And this dude has style. That is the first thing that struck me.
The thing that struck me was the incredibly bold, creative choice to make the film's protagonist the villain, right? Well, Lakeith Stanfield's character, bro. William O'Neill.
Yeah, yeah, Lakeith. Well, he's not a cop, but he's working for the cops.
Like, to make Judas the protagonist, like, of the film, is an incredibly bold creative choice, and I understand why they did it, because Fred Hampton was such a larger than life figure. To make him the sort of protagonist of the movie, it's difficult because he's almost like a superhuman, you know, whereas O'Neill is a flawed, conflicted,
human,
you know, at war with himself constantly, human, which gives the movie a much more interesting kind of narrative thrust, in which Fred Hampton is kind of almost like a god throughout it. You know, he's just this, like, I mean, which was true in real life. I mean, he was just like this almost like superhumanly inspiring human being. Like, how can you make a movie about someone like that, you know, centering his...
Without veering into absurdity and farce. And when you get to deifying somebody in film, it becomes dehumanizing, right? Like, this guy was a flesh and blood person. He wasn't some person who found the scrolls and, you know, on Mount Sinai or whatever, right? Like, he wasn't born of a virgin, right? Like, this dude was a human being with human flaws and frailties, but he had great ambitions, and his ideas spoke to the greatest sort of, ideals that human beings can aspire to pursue a life in service of others. Like, it doesn't get more inspiring than that as a human being. And that's what this dude was, right? And so you're right about that choice. And I've sort of dove into so much media that Shaka King has done around the movie. And one, I want to tell you guys, without question, Shaka King is a comrade.
Well, that's the other choice that I was going to talk about, because, like,
yes, he is. I wasn't sure how much they were going to get into that. And at a certain point, this is a movie that came out with Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
At a certain point,
can you
how
get
much
away
of
with
this
yeah.
commie socialist stuff are you really going to get through, sneak through? But he snuck through a lot.
Well, I compare it to a movie that came out last year called The Trial of the Chicago 7, which got a lot of buzz, written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. No, he's not. He is a very standard, kind of boring lib. And he basically took a group of radicals, of left-wing radicals, and turned them into, like, modern-day libs, you know? Like, that's what he did. Abbie Hoffman and the rest of the Chicago 7, who were not liberals. They did not identify as such. They were radicals. And he basically turned them into libshit. I saw the trailer for the Judas and the Black Messiah, and I'm like, I don't think they're going to do it. You know, I don't think they're going to do it. But, you know, always in the back of my mind, I was like, they're going to turn Fred Hampton into, like, you know, DeRay Mackison or some shit, you know, and it's like, he was not that at all.
They did not. In real life, he was not. And in the movie, they very carefully and meticulously explained to you what he wanted to do. He wanted to, all right, what divides the black people right now? There's some gang factions in the neighborhood. I'm gonna make sure we unite the gang factions and make them understand why it's important we do so. Why they need to understand that we will accomplish way more shit together than we will apart. And so they're like, all right, go out. And he goes out and he talks to Chicago gang members, and in such a beautiful way. And then, of course, it leads up to that scene, which I know you have something to say about, with the young patriots, who are essentially hillbilly migrants from the South living in the northern part of Chicago, poor part of Chicago. At the time, media reports called it dilapidated, drug infested, basically how they talk about all poor people in the mainstream media. And he goes up there and they're, you know, they're traditional Southern guys. They got their Confederate flags. They're doing all of this stuff. And Fred Hampton says, you know, yes, we were the slaves. You guys were the overseers, just as poor as us, but you got to be, your station was a little bit, you know, higher than us in society. But he says, what if the overseer would have gotten with the slaves and cut master's throat? When I heard that line in the movie, I said, okay, they're doing it. They're doing the thing. They're doing the thing. They're explaining what the socialist mission is, which is getting everyone in the lower class to understand that none of this other shit matters besides the class struggle. The class struggle is central to everything. And every single point in this movie, Fred Hampton does not take his eye off the ball. It's about poor people against the people who are oppressing us, the people who are in the ruling class. And the fact that they did that in this movie, man, I'm not going to lie, I got emotional.
Yeah.
Those scenes where he came back from jail and he said, with his people, there's power.
Yeah.
Say, yo, they're doing it. They're doing the freaking thing. In that speech where he kept saying, I'm high off the people.
Yeah.
That's what gets me going. That's what gets me moving. What gets me out of bed every single day is the thought of the people getting united and getting their just due. I hate to sound like a sap, Nando, but this movie made me very, very emotional. I was deeply moved by it. Just the message of it.
Yeah. I mean, that was the central premise of Fred Hampton's radicalism, right? I mean, he melded both the traditions of, like, black pride, with a very robust class analysis in which he kind of always reminded people, man, you know, poor people, I mean, white poor people, man, they get police brutality too. You know, they're hungry too. They don't get healthcare either. You know, like and it's in our interest and it's in all of our interests to band together. And if we did, we can change something. If we don't, we won't. And that's the simplest fact. It's as simple as that. I mean, in that scene, the young Patriot leader, a guy named Preacher Man, was standing in front of a Confederate flag. And one of the Panthers is like, yo, what the fuck? You know, like, rightfully so. I understand, you know, like, it's a provocation to a black person. And Fred Hampton, like, just like walks right by. Like, he doesn't even give a fuck. Like, he could care less about the symbols that are being
because it's a distraction. Expoused.
It's a distraction. But like, I did want to talk about the Young Patriots because,
yes, please.
You know, in the movie, and I understand why they did it. I mean, they didn't explicitly say it, although they hinted that they might be kind of like a modern day, like a right wing kind of Tea Party group or something. And the Young Patriots were leftists. Like they were on the left.
Explicitly so.
They were not a white supremacist organization. They were not a conservative organization. They were not a right-wing organization by any means. They were, like you said, they were a group of essentially Appalachian hillbillies who had moved to Chicago in the middle of the 20th century when there was a huge migration off of rural areas to the cities after the New Deal. But they arrived in the northern industrial centers and found poverty, essentially. Like they were just as poor as almost any other kind of immigrant group. And they were seen as, you know, they were demonized as essentially toothless hillbillies by the city's white establishment. And working with the Students for Democratic Society, SDS, they founded the Young Patriots as a way to organize these poor white communities under explicitly anti-capitalist lines and explicitly black solidarity lines. It is true that they did use the Confederate flag. And you can argue about the effectiveness of that, but it probably was effective to, you know, get some of these people on board, you know, with this kind of program. But they, from the beginning, they were explicitly like trying to cut the racial animus from like that existed amongst their population by focusing on a class message. And it is true that they then did ally with the Black Panther Party and the Young Lords, which was a Puerto Rican radical group. And, you know, so it's obviously that whole thing was destroyed. Fred Hampton's murder was a big part of it. But the Young Patriots were essentially destroyed as well by the early 1970s. It was very short lived. But these people were leftists. Like they were not right wingers who were won over by the Black Panthers. They were kind of founded on explicitly as a way to change that dynamic, to sort of create a multiracial working class alliance. And I just find their history very interesting and obviously very, you know, it's forgotten and it's been kind of erased from the history books. And I liked that the movie brought it back to the fore because that was at the core of Fred Hampton's message. You know, he's like, listen, man, class solidarity is the only thing we got. It's the only thing we got.
And he talks about it explicitly. He's like, we're not trying to create a group of black capitalists. We're not going to fight the capitalist structure with some type of racialized capitalism that could somehow become better because capitalism is the problem. That's what the entire problem is. So we're not going to come up in here and indoctrinate people to be black capitalists. No, we're explaining that the only solution to the capitalist problem is socialism. Yeah. You understand what I'm saying? Like, and it's to get people to understand that, like,
and it's the only solution to black oppression.
Yes. Period. It's not, black oppression will never be solved, and we say it all the time, by 10 more Oprahs, Jay-Z's, Michael Jordan's.
Yeah.
That will never solve the problem, y'all. Like, that's not how we get out of this. You know, like, if by nature of being a billionaire, only but so many people get to be that. And the people who get there are not going to spend their time. They're going to be like, oh, I'm a billionaire now. So now I dedicate my life to giving jobs and livable wages to the myriad of poor Black people out in the world. Like, Oprah, Jay-Z, and Puffy haven't decided that what they're going to do is uplift the poor Black people of America. That's just, that's never going to be the case. They're going to be like, here's a job at Ciroc.
Yeah.
And I'm going to underpay you, by the way. And I'm going to give you as little benefits as possible, but you get the clout of being tied to my celebrity. They're just capitalists. They're all just capitalists who happen to be Black. And
again, the FBI is fine with them.
And the FBI.
The FBI is not afraid of Jay-Z.
Never harass Jay-Z or Puffy for being Puffy and Jay-Z. Are you out of your mind? And, you know, I think that's another thing that we need to get into, Nando, that the movie takes great pains to explain to you is that the FBI, their mission, their core mission, says to them that what Fred Hampton is trying to do is a threat to the entire existence of that core mission.
Yeah.
Like, any threat to the established power, the established, not even the established power, the established power structure, right? How power gets divided upon, gets divided out. Any threat to that structure is a problem and is anathema to the existence of the FBI. Because, again, what the movie I think is trying to explain to you is that the state is an instrument of the power structure. The state is not what it's supposed to be, meaning a check on that power.
No.
It's supposed to be a check on that power, but instead it works in reverse. And the state only works to reinforce the current power structure. And that's what the FBI was doing. It was like, hold on. No. Because this guy goes to prison and he becomes a hero. No. We don't want to do that. We don't want to make him more famous. We don't want to make him a hero. Let's kill him. Let's kill him. And that's what they did.
One of my favorite scenes was when Jesse Plemons realizes that this goes like way, way higher than him. You know, Jesse Plemons is the handler for O'Neill, right? He's like one of the main villains of the movie. But he's in a way kind of like a true believer, you know, like in a way he thinks he's doing good.
He's like a white centrist lib adjacent type of guy. Basically, when you hear it when he explains that the Black Panther is two sides of the same coin as the KKK.
So like, I used to fight against the KKK.
We squashed the KKK, and we're going to squash these guys too.
Yeah. And but there's a hilarious scene. I mean, darkly funny scene, which, like, you know, he's like, oh, you know, like they found the snitch in the Philadelphia chapter or whatever. And the other FBI agent, like, who's like higher up in the organization than him, is like, oh yeah, George Sams. Yeah, we know about him. Yeah, he's he's one of ours. What are you talking about? You know, like, they killed that guy because we told them that he was the snitch. And no, but the guy who killed him is our guy. And he's like, wait, did you guys just like orchestrate like a murder? And they're like, yeah, what are you talking about? Of course. You know, like,
what else would we do? Like,
of course. What are you talking about?
And he's like, it's great because this guy is on the run for allegedly killing a snitch. And now everywhere he goes, we have the right to wiretap, bug, and raid and do. It's perfect.
It's perfect.
He's just like, this is, it's working.
And so Jesse Plemons is horrified. He's like, wait, you guys like just like orchestrated the murder of a guy, you know? And like, it's a state sanctioned like
murder,
extrajudicial murder
of an American
citizen.
And
they were like, what are you talking about? Yeah, of course. It's great. Like, I just, I read this book last year and it's mostly about Charles Manson, but it's called Chaos. It's called Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA and the Secret History of the 60s by a guy named Tom O'Neill. And there's a whole section that gets into the FBI and its operations, within the Black Panther Party, and just the extent to which the Black Panther Party was infiltrated by the FBI, which was hinted at in the movie. I mean, just by the fact that it wasn't just O'Neill, they also had George Sams, and they had thousands
of
more
course.
Like them
on payroll.
on payroll, you know, federal informants who were, you know, a lot of them, like O'Neill, were kind of forgiven for some sort of petty crime that they were going to like see serious jail time for. But like, I just want to read from a J. Edgar Hoover memo about COINTELPRO from 1967. It said that the goal of COINTELPRO, which was the FBI operation to infiltrate things like the Black Panther Party, was to expose, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, and otherwise neutralize the activities of Black nationalist hate-type organizations. The activities of all such groups of intelligence interest to this bureau must be followed on a continuous basis. Efforts of various groups to consolidate their forces or to recruit new or youthful adherents must be frustrated. No opportunity should be missed to exploit the organizational and personal conflicts of the leaderships of the groups and to capitalize upon existing conflicts between competing Black nationalist organizations. So like some of what the FBI did was things like just straight up murder Fred Hampton, right? who was like a very dangerous guy. But the vast majority of what they did were to infiltrate these organizations with agent provocateurs, meaning guys who would get in there. It's like, you know what we should do? We should like fuck those guys. Like those fucking guys, like they like yep. Fuck them. And like, we should go kill them. And like, you know, the book gets into a case in LA where the FBI fabricated a fake letter, kind of like they do in the movie at one point, where they accuse, you know, Fred Hampton of like, you know, talking shit about another gang. And they fabricate a fake letter and sent it to a rival gang in Los Angeles of the Black Panthers, or not rival gang, just like a different gang. And they said that the Black Panthers were going to come and kill them in some, you know, event that they were organizing. So then a few of those gang members went and killed two Black Panthers that were just driving by, had no idea what the hell was going on. And this led to basically a war between a lot of the LA Panthers and this rival gang called the U.S. Organization. Lots of deaths, you know, like lots of deaths. This was instigated by the FBI. And this kind of thing happened a lot. Like any sort of left-wing organization, you know, you talk about like, oh, the left always fights against itself around sectarian kind of differences. Mm-hmm. It's like often those differences are
being stoked,
exploited
by the feds.
And stoked by the feds. Exactly. And it's just, it's fascinating to read the history because, you know, in the Trump era, I think that the FBI, things like the FBI and the CIA positioned themselves as brave heroes of America against Trump.
Insane.
You know, and a lot of liberals went along with it, you know?
Insane.
Like, they were thought like Robert Mueller was bae. Remember, like, All I Want for Christmas is a Robert Mueller?
Is insane. Robert Mueller was Superman, Batman. And, like, the only thing that Donald Trump represented a disturbance in the order. The fact that he could come in and win that nomination from the Republicans, from all these
established... Was not in the script.
He was just such a disturbance in the established order. Not that he had bad politics. Not that he was, you know, somehow, you know, dangerous. It's like, no. He doesn't come from the farm system. So, no, this is we can't be anything but against somebody who threatens the established order. That's it. The order has been established. And so any interruption to that would be a problem. Like, man, like I'm obviously like everybody else who listens to this, I'm sad that Bernie did not win the nomination. But just imagine just look at the little tactics the deep state used against Donald Trump, who did nothing but show up and do what? Slash taxes for the richest people in the world. Just imagine the chicanery, the fucking what did Nixon call it? The rat fucking that the feds would have involved themselves in during a Bernie presidency.
Yeah.
That would have been scary.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Real talk, scary. I mean, the type of tactics they would use.
It's funny. I mean, you know, the modern day version of a lot of stuff that was depicted in the Fred Hampton movie, it still goes on today, especially amongst Muslim communities, like FBI literally entrapping young you know, kind of young, disaffected Muslim kids and be like, hey, you want to build a bomb and like blow up, you know,
fabricating terrorists where they are now. Right. This is what the feds do with our freaking tax dollars.
So that's still obviously going on to this day. But I want to talk about a little bit that the FBI in the 1960s was explicitly terrified of the Black Panther Party making any sort of alliances and solidarity with
poor whites.
And one of the things that they were very focused on was Hollywood. So when the Black Panthers kind of were formed in California in 1966 in Oakland, you know, in Hollywood, kind of liberal do-goody Hollywood, they became kind of like a very inspiring organization. You know, like Jane Fonda, mm-hmm. Warren Beatty, all these types were part of something called the White Panther Party, which was kind of like a solidaristic kind of
expression. Jane Fonda was out of her damn mind, by the way, in the 60s. That lady was willing to do some crazy shit.
She went to Hanoi. Yeah.
Oh, my Lord, man.
And one of these organizations in Hollywood was called the Peace and Freedom Party of California. And they were explicitly allied to the Black Panther cause. And a lot of like Hollywood celebrities and liberals and stuff like that were involved. And this is from another memo, internal memo from the FBI, talking about the problem of these white allies to the Black Panther Party. It said, the Peace and Freedom Party has been furnishing the Black Panther Party with financial assistance. An anonymous letter is being prepared for Bureau approval to be sent to a leader of the PFP, this white liberal organization, in which it is set forth that the Black Panthers has made statements in closed meetings that when the armed rebellion comes, the whites in the Peace and Freedom Party will be lined up against the wall with the rest of the whites. You know, so like that's what they were up to. And the crazy thing, the other fucking crazy thing about all of this is that we wouldn't know any of it. We wouldn't know any of this if in 1971, a group essentially left-wing, like disruptors, radicals, terrorists, whatever you want to call it, broke into an FBI office and stole all these internal documents and then slowly started leaking them out to the press. The FBI spent decades trying to find these people, and they never did. They came out in 2014 and revealed themselves as the people who broke into the FBI offices to steal all these documents. That's how we know that about the Fred Hampton operation. That's how we know about all of this shit, is because a group of people essentially burgled.
Know about COINTELPRO, all of this stuff. It became public because people burglarized the FBI.
It's crazy.
And again, just so you know, again, the state that's supposed to be working in our interest, you know, how they paint it is that they scare the well-to-do people in the burbs and say, these people are coming to kill you and then eat you like cannibals because they're animals. They're scary. Look at their fucking leather jackets. They're going to murder you.
Yeah.
Right. And again, by the way, you can't show me a bunch of Panthers going to the burbs, dragging nice crackers out of their cribs and just killing them and hanging them on the street. It's never happened. It's never happened in the history of this country. I think the film does a great job of showing you the depravity of the FBI and the aims of the FBI, right? Like what they actually cared about, not protecting, you know, our well-to-do, nice white suburban citizens. It's like, no, if these people really start rabble-rousing in this type of way, in explaining to the whites that their real enemies are the people at the top, No. Who knows what type of people they'll elect to office? Who knows what type of people they might try to kill? Who knows what type of people, you know, this rage amongst the lower class, who they might actually target it at when they're not targeting it at Mexicans, Native Americans, Black people, Puerto Ricans, et cetera, et cetera. I thought the film was brilliant in doing that. And again, if you read some of the accounts that Shaka King has given to different media outlets, he was like, yeah, I was basically, you know, I got the idea to do a story basically like The Departed, except it's based in the Black Panther Party and this informant that got Fred Hampton killed, because he's like, you kind of need that structure of you know, the sort of action thriller type of heist movie type of situation in order for you to get it made. And he's like, I wanted to show the mirrors. He explicitly has said one person represents capitalism, being self-interested, being greedy, being all about yourself. The other person represents socialism, aka working towards a common good, aka good versus evil. I can't tell you how I'm just telling you this shot. Shaka King guy has earned my respect, my love, my admiration. I'm going to be paying attention to everything he does going forward, because to Trojan horse this type of message into this level of movie is just, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that the movie's fun and entertaining. It's not like a preachy, sermon.
It's not preachy at all.
No.
And, it's Fred Hampton just explaining like, yo, man, people need shit. And they can't get it because the people at the top will never give you anything. You have to fight these fools for it, and you have to band together, and that's the only way you'll wield any type of power, right? Like, that's all the message is. It's not like, oh, if you're a good person, you'll be a commie. It's like, no, like, people have basic needs, and this is how we go about achieving them.
And the only war that matters is the class war.
That's it.
The culture war does not matter.
It doesn't.
I get, you know, like, it sucks when someone, like, says the wrong word or flies a Confederate flag or whatever, but the war that really matters is the class war. Everything else is just noise to distract us, to divide us, to make us weaker. That was the power of Fred Hampton, a guy who was like 20 years old when he was talking about this shit, and, you know, had read all of the radical texts. You know, he'd read Marx. He understood the sort of left-wing traditions that he felt
in
a
the
part
movie.
Of.
They quoted Chairman Mao at one of the freaking like in a context of China is great. Then here's why. They quoted Chairman Mao. It's insane, dude. This movie.
Yeah. And they didn't turn it into lib shit. That's just the biggest miracle. I mean, I don't know. I was like thinking about it. I couldn't stop thinking about it because that this was kind of like the anti Black Panther movie. I mean, the movie Black Panther, which you know, you can enjoy and find entertaining, and I that's fine. But if you look at its politics, it is like a reactionary as fuck movie. that is a reactionary movie. I mean, I'm sorry. It's about a monarchy essentially allying with the CIA to stop a Black radical, essentially, you know, that's like what it is. Martin Freeman is the CIA agent, and, you know, he allies with an unelected monarch to stop the rise of a Black radical. And that this movie was kind of the anti-Black Panthers movie about the actual Black Panthers and their radical socialist message, a message of solidarity, of Black pride, but of solidarity with all people of all colors who are in the working class, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, no matter what words you use to describe other people. We are all suffering under the boot of capitalism, and that the only way we're going to be liberated is to end that.
We talked about Black Panther very briefly on Bomb, and we had a great discussion, but I just couldn't help myself. I was like, me and Nando have to talk about this, just as, you know, the type of people who love pop culture. We love the art that is produced in mass and pop culture, and we're always starved for art that actually speaks to the things that we actually care about, right? Like, it's rare that we actually ever get that art. In the real time, as I was watching this movie, I was like, oh my God, they're doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
They are doing it.
I would love to get Lakeith Stanfield's take on it, because he was in Judas and the Black Messiah, but he was also in Sorry to Bother You, directed by Boots Riley, who is a communist.
Yes, he is.
and you know, that movie is basically about how, like, calling your congressman ain't going to cut it. Like, the only way to get anything done is through labor power, through labor unions. And I was like, I couldn't believe they somehow shoehorned an entertaining movie into that.
I've watched a few Daniel Kaluuya interviews, and he seems to understand that Chairman Fred Hampton's message is about everything we're doing right now. And he seems to internalize what the actual message was about. It's like, you know, racial solidarity is great, but what Chairman Hampton was on was a whole other bag of whatever. And it's just wild. Yeah. I can't say enough about it. Yeah. It's just wild.
No, it was great. I was very happy to see, you know, the treatment of it. I mean, Fred Hampton has always been kind of an inspirational figure for me in so many ways. When I saw that they were making a movie out of it, I was like, okay, let's see. And they fucking delivered. I mean, the other thing that was announced is another, Barack Obama, our friend of the show, just announced that he's going to do a biopic on Bayard Rustin, directed by the guy who directed the Ma Rainey movie. And again, I'm like, you know, Bayard Rustin is an absolute hero of mine, the sort of forgotten civil rights hero. Martin Luther King's, like, socialist ear was him. And the fact that Obama and his production company are doing it, like, I'm just like, oh, come on. Don't turn him into, like, some lib shit, you know? Like, you know, like, don't fucking turn him into some lib shit.
Yeah.
Because he was not. He would have hated that, you know?
No, thank you. All right. Well, that's our show for this week. Of course, thank you guys for listening. Make sure you're checking out every single other Count the Dings offering, whether it be Cinephobe, the Friday Mailbag, the OG Show, Wednesday Service with Naima and Curran, Growing Up the Same with Jay and Black Trey. Of course, please, if you can, become a Patreon at patreon.com/countthedings. That's how we're able to produce this wonderful content for you week after week. Man, we appreciate you guys for tuning in. For Nando Vila, I'm Big Waz. We're out of here.
Later.
Peace.